Okay, we are continuing our study of the Gospel of Matthew here on the Listener's Commentary. And on this recording, we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 through 39. And just to keep the overarching context in mind, remember that in this section, really from chapter 14 all the way up through most of chapter 16, what Matthew is doing is he's collecting various snapshots that show different kinds of people's responses to Jesus and his ministry and ushering in the kingdom of heaven. The last snapshot in our previous recording, it was some Pharisees from Jerusalem. And they're supposed to be leading people to God, but Jesus says they're actually blind guides, blinded by their traditions, and they're actually leading people to break God's commands. Well, here in this section, picking up in verse 21 of chapter 15, we leave Galilee. We travel to the northwest and we meet a Gentile woman. And so we're actually traveling outside of Jewish lands and into a Gentile area. Jesus, we know from the rest of the context and the other gospels and what's going on in Jesus' life, Jesus is trying to get away from Herod for a little bit. He's trying to get alone with his disciples and spend more time focusing on his disciples and their training before things culminate in the final week of his life that leads up to his crucifixion. And so Jesus travels north out of Galilee and into Gentile lands. And so we pick up in Matthew 15, verse 21, and it reads like this. Jesus went away from there, that is from the area around Capernaum and Gennesaret and Galilee. He went away from there and withdrew into the region of Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon are two well-known large cities up towards the northwest outside of Israel. You can read various interactions with Tyre and Sidon in the stories of the Old Testament. They're well-known from Old Testament history, pagan cities in the Old Testament. At times they were friends with Israelite kings. At times they were enemies. And so there's a long-standing history with this region just to the northwest of Galilee. And so Jesus withdrew there, and it seems like he's really trying to get away from Herod and just get away from the crowds, get away from the crush of everyday ministry so that he could just focus on the 12, focus on himself, focus on what lies ahead. So it's like a bit of a retreat from the tense situation going on in Galilee and the notoriety of the crowds. And while he's there, here's what happens, verse 22. And a Canaanite woman from that region. So it specified in verse 21 that he didn't necessarily go into the city of Tyre or into the city of Sidon, but the area around it. And so here comes a Canaanite woman from that area, that region. She came out and began crying out, saying, and we'll read what she says here in a little bit, but it's interesting to note right up front here that Matthew uses the word Canaanite to describe her. In Mark's gospel, which tells the same story, she's just a Syrophoenician woman, which is sort of just a kind of a general word for the region, Syria and Phoenicia. And so it describes more her with a regional name. But Matthew chooses this word, Canaanite, which is an old word not used elsewhere in the New Testament. It actually calls to mind the Canaanites from the Old Testament. If you're familiar with your Old Testament of the Bible, that it was the Canaanites that the Israelites were supposed to drive out of the land. It was the Canaanites who were a persistent menace to Old Testament Israel and led them regularly into idolatry. So a Jew calling somebody a Canaanite was really a bad word, a bad thing. And Matthew highlights then by this word how far this particular woman is from the people of God in Israel. Like she's far removed. Her heritage, her history, her background all keeps her outside of Israel. So this woman comes out. She finds Jesus, knows that he's there, heard reports that he's there. Rumors have swirled probably out of Galilee to this region about this miracle worker in Galilee, and she wants him to help her. And so she comes out to him crying out, it says, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed." So her daughter is has some issue, some manifestation that this woman says indicates she's demon-possessed. But notice how she addresses Jesus. She calls him by two titles, Lord, which could be just a sign of respect. People could use the word kurios, Lord, just as like sir, as a title of respect or honor. But combined with the next title, it suggests something maybe a little bit higher, that she sees him as not just like maybe a Jew that she wants to show respect for, or maybe even a holy man she wants to show respect for, but she thinks maybe he's more than that. And so she calls him also Son of David, which, as we've seen throughout the Gospel of Matthew, is very much a messianic title. And so she has some knowledge of the Jews and Jewish history and Jewish hopes and longing of the Messiah. And she thinks Jesus, because of the rumors that she's heard, might just be him, and she certainly believes he can help her daughter. And so she comes asking for help. And so she cries out. There's probably a crowd, an entourage around him, and she's crying out, and Jesus doesn't respond. Look at verse 23. But he did not answer her, even with a word. And she likely wouldn't have been totally surprised by this, given the attitude of a typical Jew, particularly a Jewish male, with sort of leadership roles to people such as her. And so Jesus really is, in some regards, like a traditional Jewish teacher. And there's this crowd, and there's crying out, and she's crying out, asking for help, and Jesus doesn't respond. Now, we have to read this sentence, I think, in the context of the entire little story here in Matthew 15, and as well as in all of Matthew's gospel. Jesus is here in the context of the story to get away from the pressure and the strain and the crowds for a while. He's trying to stay on the down low a little bit. She is calling out, trying to get his attention, and she's using these titles that will only draw more attention to him. And he doesn't want to be involved in a ministry of healing right now, because that will only attract even more people out when he's trying to get away from the crowds and ministry. So he ignores her, but she's persistent and has such confidence in Jesus that she eventually wins him over as the story unfolds, and he'll commend her warmly and highly. So let's not get too bothered by how Jesus responds here up front. And so she cries out, he doesn't answer, and then his disciples come up in the middle of verse 23 and urged him, saying, send her away because she keeps shouting at us. Now, the wording here suggests that she's following behind, calling out loudly, and that she's really starting, you know, a commotion of some sort. She just won't be denied. She has complete confidence that Jesus can help, and she's insistent. And so she keeps shouting at them from her place in the crowd and keeps asking loudly. Now, what did the disciples mean by send her away? Well, it sounds like just chase her away. The disciples themselves could have done that, chased her away, told her to be quiet, but they don't. And the way Jesus responds to what the disciples say here actually makes it sound like maybe something more is going on. Look what Jesus says in verse 24. He says, he answered and said to them, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Notice this is addressed to what the disciples say, but the woman hears his words. So my picture, as I'm picturing the story, is they're talking, they're walking, there's a crowd around him, she's shouting, the disciples are finally telling him, look, let's end this whole thing. And Jesus stops and looks at the 12 and says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And that answer sounds like maybe Jesus understands the disciples to be saying something like, look, just do what she's saying and then send her on her way because she's causing a commotion and it's not really helping. And I think maybe that's what's going on, although it's not totally clear here, that when the disciples say send her away, they're not saying just chase her away. They're saying do what she asks and send her on her way. I wish we could see a little bit more of what was going on. Now, one more note on this, and that is the idea of Jesus being sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. We saw the same notion in chapter 10, verse 5, where during his ministry on earth, the focus of Jesus' energies and ministry was going to be on the Jews. But by the end of the gospel, he's sending his disciples to the Gentiles, out to the nations. And so right now he's focusing on Israel. Eventually the ministry is going to go the whole way out to the Gentiles. This doesn't mean that he doesn't have anything to do with Gentiles. And so here they're in this Gentile region, and this is what he tells his disciples is not now. But she hears it and she approaches the group, and here's what happens. Verse 25, but she comes up to the group. Seeing that they've stopped, maybe overhearing what was going on, she came up and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." This is her immediate response. And this suggests to me that the tone of Jesus' voice, maybe even the look in his eye, the nature of the conversation between Jesus and his disciples, it doesn't snub her, it doesn't shame her, it doesn't force her to want to leave. Actually, she still senses maybe the door is open to her. So now that they've stopped and she was following behind, she approaches, bows down in a show of respect, and makes her appeal, "Lord, help me." Jesus answered in verse 26 and said, "It's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, she's called him Lord and Son of David. So whatever she understands, in some sense, she thinks he is the Jewish Messiah. She may have a different picture in mind, right? We're not sure exactly how she understood that, but she's used a messianic title for him, and she thinks he can help. She believes he can help. And Jesus' response here in verse 26 seems to be a bit of a playful response as I read it. The children, when he says it's not good to take the children's bread, that refers to the Jews. And the dogs here would refer to, in context, to people other than the Jews, like herself. But Jesus actually uses a unique word for dog. It's not the word that refers to the wild scavenger dogs roaming the streets looking for food. It's a word that refers to little dogs that in some Gentile context would be house pets. That's the word he uses. So it's sort of a playful response, basically by saying, we don't want to take the table food that we're supposed to serve the kids and put it on the floor and give it to the dogs, do we? And then she responds in a way that says she gets what Jesus is saying. She hears it as a playful response, and she's totally engaged. Look at verse 27. She said, "Yes, Lord, that's true. You wouldn't take the table food and give it to the kids. Nevertheless, even the dogs feed," she says, "on the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Notice that she fully engages. Jesus says what he says, so whatever the look on his face is and the tone of his voice is, doesn't shame her again, doesn't push her away. It draws her in, and she's fully engaged, and she understands that the focus of his ministry right now might be on the Jews, the children. So she says, "Yes, Lord. Yes, it's not appropriate to take the food that's supposed to be for the children and give it to the dogs. That may be true, but even the dogs in a house, even the little pets under the table, they get the table scraps. They get the things that fall on the floor from the little kids." So she's basically saying, "Look, Lord, I get it. I understand that's the case. But could you just give me a crumb? Could you just give me a crumb?" And Jesus is deeply impressed. And so he says to her in verse 28, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed at once. At the start of the story, we noted that it almost feels like Jesus is being rude. He's ignoring her. He's wishing she would just go away, right? But we can't really see what's going on. We can't even hear the tone of the voices, and we don't have all the details in the story. So as the story unfolds, we're like, what's going on? And then we see this woman engaging and engaging more and engaging more with Jesus until we get to this point in the story in verse 28, and we get this warm, kind affirmation of this Gentile woman, this woman who's far outside and far removed historically and all of that from Israel and the people of God. Jesus says to her, "Oh woman, your faith is great." Like you really believe. You believe enough not to be put off. You believe enough to even ask for just a crumb. And he says to her, "It shall be done as you desire." And her daughter was healed at once. And so this is a warm affirmation of this woman and her engagement and her confidence in Jesus. And the result of that is that her daughter is healed. Well, Matthew continues telling the story in verse 29, and it continues like this, departing from there. So leaving there, we don't know how long he was there. We don't know everything else he did that was there. Matthew just gives us one snapshot because it fits in with this theme of different kinds of people and their response to Jesus. So we've seen the disciples maybe struggling with faith, being of little faith. We've seen Pharisees and scribes from Jerusalem having no faith and being blind guides. Now we have this Gentile woman who has great faith. And then going on from there in verse 39, Jesus went along the Sea of Galilee. So he goes back down to the Sea of Galilee. And after going up on a mountain, he was sitting there. Now we don't know exactly where he is at because it doesn't specify it here in Matthew's gospel. A number of commentaries say this continues the idea of Jesus ministering to Gentiles. But if you read Matthew, he never indicates that. He doesn't specify that. Mark does. Mark indicates that the region Jesus goes to is the Decapolis, which is a Gentile region. And so commentaries that say this continues Jesus ministering to the Gentiles are really importing that idea from Mark into the Gospel of Matthew. But Matthew leaves that out. And if he had wanted to communicate the idea of ministering to Gentiles, it would have been easy. He just would have had to do what Mark did and say that Jesus went to the Decapolis. But Matthew doesn't do that. So it seems to me that to say Matthew's continuing the idea of ministering to Gentiles ignores what Matthew actually says. Continuing ministry to Gentiles may have been Mark's point, but I don't think it's Matthew's. Matthew just focuses more on Jesus' power and his compassion in general, as well as the training of the 12 to trust him and trust his power. So the snapshot here begins with Jesus sitting there on a hillside somewhere unspecified by Matthew. And a large crowd in verse 30, large crowds came to him, bringing with him those who were limping, who had impaired limbs, who were blind or who were unable to speak, and many others. And they laid them down at Jesus' feet and he healed them. And this shows his power as well as his compassion. They're bringing all these people and Jesus healed them. So the crowd in verse 31 was astonished as they saw those who were unable to speak now talking, those with impaired limbs restored, those who had been limping walking around, those who had been blind now seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. And so their response is astonished. And remember, in the snapshots that Matthew's putting together in chapters 14, 15, and 16, he's showing different people's response. And here the response is, they're amazed. They have wonder. They're astonished at this. And the other part of the response is, they glorified the God of Israel. And that phrase, the God of Israel, is noted by some commentators to say, see, it is talking about Gentiles. And it may be, right, based on Mark. But in the Old Testament, this very phrase, the God of Israel, was actually used by Israelites as well. So at best, that phrase is ambiguous. It doesn't make it explicit that we're talking about Gentiles. I'm not saying we're not. I think Mark is telling us the truth about that. It's just, as Matthew has told the story, he hasn't emphasized that. The point here is more the people's response, that they're astonished and that they glorify God. Now, after that, Matthew continues what happens in this setting with Jesus healing these whole crowds of people. It says, now Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I feel compassion for the people because they've remained with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat. I do not want to send them away hungry because they might faint on the way. You almost kind of get the sense that Jesus is setting them up. Will they remember the last feeding? Has their faith grown at all? Right? And so it's like a setup, it seems like. And we don't really know exactly how long it's been. It's likely been at least 4 or 5 months since the feeding of the 5,000. It's been a good number of months. We're in a different region. Will they remember? Will they expect Jesus to do it again, right? And so Jesus is kind of setting them up for that. And this is what happens, verse 33. The disciples said to him, where would we get so many loaves in this desolate place to satisfy such a large crowd? Now, we can't hear their tone of voice or see the look on their face, so we can't see if, okay, did they sense that Jesus was setting them up? And are they kind of responding like they did before and with a look of like, okay, are we doing this again? Or are they responding with really like a genuine question? We don't 100% know, but we know what happens. Look at verse 34. And Jesus said to them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7 and a few small fish. Again, in the region of Galilee, bread and fish, standard part of the staple part of the diet. Not surprising that it's the same sort of things we had in the feeding of the 5,000. And so Jesus, once again, verse 35, directed the people to sit on the ground. He took the 7 loaves and the fish, gave thanks, and broke them and started passing them out to the disciples once again. And the disciples gave them to the crowd. And I imagine after all of this, as we're doing this again, the disciples, all of a sudden the lights come on if they hadn't before. And they're like, here we go again. We've done this before. And so they keep coming with their baskets. They keep getting more bread and fish. They keep passing them out to the crowds. And it all sounds very familiar, right? In fact, Jesus is going to recall both of these feeding miracles, the feeding of the 5,000 and this one here that'll involve 4,000 men. He's going to recall both of them in chapter 16 to challenge the disciples and their faith and their trust in him. And that seems to be really the main theme that Matthew wants to emphasize by telling this story here that is so similar to what happened before. And look at verse 37. And they all ate, all the people ate and were satisfied. And they picked up the leftovers of broken pieces again, this time 7 large baskets full. With the feeding of the 5,000, it was 12 baskets full. Here it's 7 large baskets full. And those who ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. And so there was the feeding of the 5,000 besides women and children. Here it's 4,000 besides women and children. And sending the crowds away, Jesus got into the boat and came to the region of Megiddon. Megiddon, we're not really sure where that is. Some later manuscripts actually have Megdala instead of Megiddon. And maybe they refer to the same place. Maybe it was a convenient change. We're just not 100% certain. But they sailed back across the sea to some place, either Megdala or Megiddon, which may be the same place. Now, why do we have two stories that are so similar within just a few pages of the gospel account? Well, one of the things that's important when we're studying a narrative text like the gospels is you really have kind of like two kinds of questions that have to be answered in wrestling with the meaning of the text. One is the historical question and one is the literary question. The historical question is, what happened? What are the historical details? And the literary question is, why did the author tell us what happened, the way he told us, and where he told us in his narrative, in his story? You have both those questions going on. And so at the historical level, with the historical question, the feeding of the 4,000, this event we just read, probably did take place in Gentile territory, in the Decapolis, as Mark notes. That's probably where it took place. And so at the historical level, it was a way of Jesus revealing himself to those people, serving those people, and showing his disciples that he cared for Gentiles as well. So at the historical level, with the simple what happened, that's probably what happened. But as we noted as we went through it, Matthew doesn't mention that at all. He doesn't mention the Decapolis. There's almost no real hints of Gentile stuff throughout the text. And so that really isn't the focus of Matthew's narrative in telling the story. So at the literary level, with the literary question, how does this fit into or function within Matthew's gospel? That's a literary question. Why here? Why did Matthew tell it the way he told it? Why did he leave out the Decapolis detail, right? So how does this fit or function in Matthew's gospel? Well, Matthew's going to record how Jesus recalls this episode to challenge and correct his disciples about his power and identity. And so it seems to me that Matthew is simply using this story to reinforce the message of who Jesus is, the kind of authority he has, how he uses that authority for the good of other people with compassion. He felt compassion for the people. He healed their sick, right? We see his power used in compassionate ways for the good of other people. And so this story, the feeding of the 4,000, is another snapshot of Jesus's compassion and power revealing his identity. It's another demonstration to get his disciples and us to see, who is he? Who is this one? Why? Well, because sometimes, maybe a lot of the times, the lesson has to be repeated multiple times for us to get it. And I think that's what's going on in Matthew's gospel. He's told it the way he's told it, simply to help us see who Jesus is and how he uses his power and authority so that we will learn this lesson. All right, thanks for tuning into this session of the Listener's Commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. The Listener's Commentary is a listener-supported, crowd-funded Bible teaching ministry that's made possible by the generous support of people just like you. So thanks a ton to all you who make this ministry possible. And if you've been blessed or impacted in some way by the Listener's Commentary, could I invite you just to maybe reflect prayerfully if there's any way you could support this ministry so that it can continue to grow and impact more people, and we could continue to build out and flesh out the study hub. One of the things that I really hope to be able to produce soon is an app to make the commentary way more accessible. It's so hard to access all the older episodes on a podcast app, but if I have my own app and we can set it up the way we want, then you can have it right on your phone. So there's a lot of things that we want to achieve, and we just need the resources to do it. So if you would prayerfully consider if you could help this ministry continue to grow and increase, that would be a huge blessing to all the people and more who would use this resource if they could find it. So thanks a ton in advance for your support.